Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm the host of Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy heard every Friday night right here on KCRW. And tonight's subject is Woody Allen. Now, I know that I have already done two shows on Woody Allen over the past year and a half since this show has begun, and but it has come to my attention that there are those of you out there that do not listen to every single program for whatever reasons you may have. And although I don't like to encourage this, I understand it, and I keep getting letters from people that would like to hear a show on Woody Allen. And so here's a show on Woody Allen, even though I've already done two. Some of this stuff I haven't played before, and I think you'll find enjoyable. What can you say about Woody Allen that hasn't been said a million times? Well, I think the main thing you can say is that he made some wonderful records that don't get talked about much. They were done during his stand-up years, around 64 through 67 or so, and there were three of them. There were two on Coal Pix, which is now defunct, and one on Capitol. All three records are very hard to find now, and but have been edited down to a two-record set, which you can still pick up and is still worth getting because it has most of the good stuff. And I think it's some of his very best and very strongest material. He keeps going back to, you'll hear some things possibly that you've heard before in the movies. He keeps going back to this material and mines it for his films. And it really is some of his strongest material, as I'm sure you'll agree if you've never heard it before. If you have heard it before, I'm sure you're going to just love to hear it again. The first thing we're going to hear, though, is something that's not off of one of his records, but it's from the album of That Was the Week That Was, which is a fairly obscure record. And this was done sometime between 64 and 65, and is rarely heard. So let's hear that, and then we'll turn to some of Woody Allen's own records.
Years ago, when I was still married, I had a bad marriage. Let me begin this at the very beginning. My wife and I thought that we were in love, but it turned out to be benign. It was a rough marriage. I had married, actually, one of the few white Muslims in New York. And we didn't get along, and we joined on Lexington Avenue in New York. There's a civil defense group where you meet a couple of times a week, and they coach you on civil defense. And in the event of a hydrogen bombing or something, they issue you a flashlight. And you can hold it up, you know, and it's mostly social. We used to have cocktails a couple of times, you know, and once a week we'd play a softball game against the pacifists. And at that time, Rockefeller wanted a couple to test out his air raid shelter program. They wanted to see if a married couple could live in a confined area 20 by 20 feet for 2 weeks without trouble. And my wife volunteered us for it. I was not working at the time. I had been fired when I was thrown out of college. And when I was thrown out, I got a job on Madison Avenue in a real dyed-in-the-wool advertising agency wanted a man to come in and to pay him $95 a week and to sit in their office and to look Jewish. They wanted to prove to the outside world that they would hire minority groups, you know. So I was the one that they hired there. I was the show Jew with the agency. I tried to look Jewish desperately, you know. I used to read my memos from right to left all the time. They finally fired me because I took off too many Jewish holidays. We did this. We entered the air raid shelter on Monday morning at 11:30. We went in, my wife and me. They shut the door. We sat there and we faced each other. And we chatted. And we read. And we ate three very nice meals. By then already it was noon. She was beginning to get on my nerves. Tuesday we spent most of our time just standing in the center of the room shrieking. Wednesday we played gin rummy and she came at me with an axe. And Thursday my wife's spirits began to lift perceptibly. She woke up Thursday morning. She was smiling. She was laughing. She laughed straight through till the following Wednesday. She woke up on the next Thursday and she said to me, "Does the king suspect?" I left the shelter. She's still there. It's been 4 years. You can write to her if you want to.
And listen, I've been up here for a while, and I don't know how many out there noticed. but I do not have what you would call a stock theatrical suntan. At all, I'm redheaded and fair-skinned, and when I go to the beach, I don't tan. I stroke. I never used to go to the beach because I come from Brooklyn. We only had Coney Island, which was an awful beach. There were rumors during the war that enemy submarines, German subs, came into the bathing area at Coney Island. And they were destroyed by the pollution. And the only time I bathed was with Mrs. Allen, I guess, my wife, the dread Mrs. Allen. Honeymooning. I was fabulous. You would have adored me. I was on water skis. Stripped to the waist. Skiing fast across the top of the surf. My hair back. I oiled my muscle. It's really holding on with one hand, water skiing. Very great. My wife was in the boat ahead of me, rowing frantically. I got a very bad burn, really bad. And I was thinking when I was a kid, I was ashamed of having red hair because I lived in a tough section. I lived in a sub-basement walk-down, under-street level, janitor-style. The janitor at our apartment during the Depression had some stocks, and the market crashed, and he was wiped out, and he tried to kill himself by jumping out the window up onto street level. I was the sensitive kid, poet. There were tough kids in my class. There was a kid in my class named Floyd. Floyd used to sit in the dumb row in school. You know? Vegetable mentality, you know? I made friends with him years later when we got older. I removed a thorn from his paw. You know? Once I was on my way for my violin lesson when I was a kid. And I'm walking past the pool room. And Floyd and all his friends are out, you know, they're swiping hubcaps in Brooklyn from moving cars, which is really amazing. And I walk past and he yells out to me, "Hey, Red." I was a cocky kid. Put down my violin. I go up to him. I said, "My name is not Red. If you want me, call me by my regular name. It's Master Haywood Allen." I spent that winter in a wheelchair. A team of doctors labored to remove a violin. Lucky it wasn't a cello. I'm not a fighter. I have bad reflexes and I can't fight. I was once run over by a car with a flat tire being pushed by two guys. And I was not in the army, in case you're wondering. I was in the canine corps. Strange story, when I was younger, I wanted a dog, and we had no money. My father at the time was caddy at a miniature golf course in Brooklyn. You know? I couldn't get a dog, because it was too much, and they finally opened up in my neighborhood in Flatbush, a damaged pet shop. They sold damaged pets at discount, you know. You could get a bent pussycat if you wanted. A straight camel, you know. I got a dog that stuttered. That's why the cats would give him a hard time, and he would go, "Bow wow." He turned all red, you know. We wanted to send him into the army, but the papers got crossed up and they got me instead of him. I was in the canine corps for 2 weeks. Me and 11 dogs was the outfit. He taught me how to heal. Sergeant was a little Mexican hairless, you know? I was not in the regular army. I was classified 4P by the draft board. In the event of war, I'm a hostage. When I was in little boy, I wanted a dog desperately. And we had no money. I was a tiny kid. And my parents couldn't get me a dog because we just didn't have the money. So they got me, instead of a dog, they told me it was a dog. They got me an ant. And I didn't know any better, you know. I thought it was a dog. I was a dumb kid. I called it Spot. I trained it, you know. I'm coming home late one night, and Sheldon Finkelstein tried to bully me. Spot was with me. And I said, kill! And Sheldon stepped on my dog. I was standing in front of my schoolyard, and a black sedan pulls up, and two guys get out, and they say to me, do I want to go away with them to a land where everybody is fairies and elves, and I could have all the comic books I want, and chocolate, and wax lips, you know? And I said yes, you know? And I got into the car with them, because I figured, you know, what the hell, I was home that weekend from college anyhow, you know? They drive me off, and they send a ransom note to my parents. And my father has bad reading habits. So he gets into bed at night with the ransom note. And he read half of it, you know. And he got drowsy and fell asleep. Then he lent it out, you know. Meanwhile, they take me to New Jersey, bound and gagged. And my parents finally realize that I'm kidnapped. And they snap into action immediately. They rent out my room. The ransom note says for my father to leave $1,000 in a hollow tree in New Jersey. He has no trouble raising $1,000, but he gets a hernia carrying the hollow tree. The FBI surround the house. Throw the kid out, they say. Give us your guns and come out with your hands up. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out, but let us keep our guns and get to our car. The FBI says, throw the kid out. We'll let you get to your car, but give us your guns. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out. And let us keep our guns. We don't have to get to our car. The FBI says, keep the kid. The FBI decides to lob in tear gas, but they don't have tear gas. So several of the agents put on the death scene from Camille. Tear-stricken, my abductors give themselves up. They're sentenced to 15 years on a chain gang, and they escape, 12 of them, chained together at the ankle, getting by the guards posing as an immense charm bracelet.
I was talking about this on TV last week. I escape always into a rich fantasy life that comes from an unhappy childhood. My parents did not want me when I was a child. They put a live teddy bear in my crib, you know? I come from a poor family. My father worked at Coney Island. He had a concession on the boardwalk where you knock over milk bottles with baseballs, which I could never do for my entire childhood. There was a tidal wave at Coney Island when I was a child that ripped up the boardwalk and did about $1 million worth of damage, houses and everything. The only thing left standing were those little milk bottles, you know? I would say over-disciplined, which is really humiliating. I had to be home 9:30 prom night. I made a reservation at the Copacabana for 5 o'clock. I took my date and we watched them set up.
Now, I was invited when I was a kid, I will never forget this, to Seymour Gutkin's birthday party. And I loathe birthday parties because my mother used to make me wear my cousin's hand-me-downs all the time, you know, and she was not my size, you know, it's really you, right? And so I wouldn't lose them. My mother would pin my mittens to my sleeves, you know, and that day I had on a short-sleeve shirt and I looked like this, you know, I was strangling. And at that age, I identified with Superman. That was my thing. I felt Superman and I had many traits in common. He used to go into telephone booths and remove his clothing all the time. So did I, you know. And I took my parents' best tablecloth, their Hotel Dixie tablecloth, and I tie it around my neck, you know, a pin there, and it drapes behind me, and I look like Superman, but really good. And I tuck my cape tablecloth in, and I'm ready for action. And I go out to Gutkin's birthday party, and I'm riding the BMT subway. And I'm coming into the Avenue J station in Brooklyn, and I look out on the platform, and I see Hermina Jaffe is being molested. Hermina Jaffe, I adored. She was the wildest kid in school. She was 5 years old, but an absolute murderer. She was sexy. She had an overbite, and that killed me, you know? She had the biggest overbite in Brooklyn, you know? She used to eat a piece of toast and finish the outer edge first on. So the train pulls into the platform, and I get out, you know, and the doors open there, and I take my cape out behind me, you know, and I'm really looking like Superman. I was a dashing kid, and she's being annoyed by Guy de Maupassant Rabinowitz. He was the worst kid in the neighborhood. I loathe him. In the early 1940s, in the Roosevelt-Dewey election, his parents voted for Hitler. And I say to him, you know, take your hands off her, Gita. And I pull my cape out, you know. I really look Supermanish. And he says to me, knock off, Four Eyes. I have bad eyesight and I'm sensitive about it. When I take an eye test, the optometrist points to the letters and he calls them out. And he says, true or false. And I'm all set to smack him in the mouth and the doors to the subway close on my cape and the train pulls out. I'm hanging by my neck for 22 blocks, you know, trains are going past me and the third rail is underfoot. And I don't know if you know the New York subway system or not, but that's safer than riding inside the train. I was, as a matter of fact, when I think of it, terrorized as an adolescent. I was not that young when it happened. I was, I guess about 13 or so at the time. I was on my way to an amateur music contest. And my family is musical. You should know that. My father used to play the tuba as a young man. He tried to play the tuba. He tried to play Flight of the Bumblebee on the tuba. He blew his liver out through the horn. You know? And I'm on the subway with my clarinet, Jerry jazz musician style, unwrapped and everything. And these 12 guys come running through the subway, but really hairy knuckle types, you know, race through. Apparently they had just come from a settlement house, you know, because they were dribbling a social worker as they went through the car, you know? But they stop right over me, you know, because I was conspicuous because I had just eaten a seafood lunch and I'd forgotten to remove the lobster bib, you know? So I look like a farmer with a fat tie, you know, and Neptune on it. They stand over me and they start cursing and smoking and tearing up seats, you know, and I don't say anything, you know. I just sit there and look down, continue reading Heidi. And all of a sudden, the leader puts his finger under my neck like this and goes, phew. I got up. And he snapped his knee up quickly, and I refused to give him the satisfaction of doubling over. But I did one of the greatest imitations of Lily Pons you've ever heard. I hit an M over high C on the BMT. Showed up an hour late for the music contest. Came in second, anyhow. I won 2 weeks at interfaith camp, where I was sadistically beaten by boys of all races and creeds.
I was down south once, and I was invited to a costume party. And I rarely go to them. I went to one when I was younger. I went in my underwear shorts, and I have varicose veins, you know, and I went as a road map, you know? And I figured, what the hell? It's Halloween. I'll go as a ghost. I take a sheet off the bed and I throw it over my head. And I go to the party. And you have to get the picture. I'm walking down the street in a deep southern town. I have a white sheet over my head. And a car pulls up and three guys with white sheets say, "Get in." So I figure there's guys going to the party as ghosts. And I get into the car and I see we're not going to the party and I tell them. And they say, "Well, we have to go pick up the Grand Dragon." And all of a sudden it hits me. Down south, white sheets, the Grand Dragon. I put two and two together. And I figure there's a guy going to the party dressed as a dragon. All of a sudden, a big guy enters the car, and I'm sitting there between four Klansmen, four big arm men, and the door's locked, and I'm petrified. I'm trying to pass desperately. You know, I'm saying, "You all," and "Grits." You know, I must have said "grits" 50 times. They'd ask me a question. I'd say, "Oh, grits, grits." And next to me is the leader of the Klansmen. You can tell he's the leader because he's the one wearing contour sheets. You know? And they dragged me to an empty field, and I gave myself away because they asked for donations, and everybody there gave cash. When it came to me, I said, "I pledge $50. They knew immediately. They took my hood off and threw a rope around my neck. They decided to hang me. And suddenly my whole life passed before my eyes. I saw myself as a kid again in Kansas going to school and swimming at the swimming hole and fishing and frying up a mess o' catfish. Going down to the general store, getting a piece of gingham for Emmy Lou. And I realize it's not my life. They're gonna hang me in 2 minutes. The wrong life is passing in front of my eyes. And I spoke to them. I was really eloquent. I said, "Fellas, this country can't survive unless we love one another, regardless of race, creed, or color." And they were so moved by my words that not only did they cut me down and let me go, but that night I sold them $2,000 worth of Israel bonds. Me if I would tell this story. A long time ago, it's a weird story, I was out in Los Angeles, and I was at a party with a very big Hollywood producer, and at that time they wanted to make an elaborate CinemaScope musical comedy out of the Dewey Decimal System. And they wanted me to work on it. And I go out to the producer's building in downtown Los Angeles, and I walk into his elevator, and there are no people in the elevator, no buttons on the wall or anything, and I hear a voice say, "Kindly call out your flaws, please." And I look around, and I'm alone. And I panic, and I read on the wall that it's a new elevator, and it works on a sonic principle, and it's all sound. All I have to do is say what floor I want to go to, and it takes me there. So I say, "3, please." And the doors close, and the elevator starts going up to 3. And on the way up, I began to feel very self-conscious, because I talk, I think, with a slight New York accent. And the elevator spoke quite well. And I get out, and I'm walking down the hall, and I look back, and I thought I heard the elevator make a remark. And I turn quickly, and the door's closed, and the elevator goes down, you know, and I
didn't want to get involved at that time with an elevator in Hollywood. But this is the strange part of the story that was the normal part. I have never in my life had good relationships with mechanical objects of any sort, anything that I can't reason with or kiss or fondle. I get into trouble with. I have a clock that runs counterclockwise for some reason, and my toaster pops up my toast and shakes it and burns it, and I hate my shower. If I'm taking a shower and someone in America uses his water, that's it for me, you know. I leap from the tub scalded. I have a tape recorder. I paid $150 for it. And as I talk into it, it goes, I know, I know. About 3 years ago, I couldn't stand it anymore. I was home one night. I called a meeting of my possessions. I got everything I owned into the living room, my toaster, my clock, my blender. They'd never been in the living room before. And I spoke to them. I opened with a joke. And then I said, I know what's going on, and cut it out. I have a sun lamp, and as I sit under it, it rains on me. And I spoke to each appliance. I was really articulate. And then I put them back, and I felt good. And 2 nights later, I'm watching my portable television set. And the set begins to jump up and down. And I go up to it, and I always talk before I hit. And I said, I thought we had discussed this. What's the problem? And the set kept going up and down, so I hit it. And it felt good hitting it. And I beat the hell out of it as well. I was really great. I tore off the antenna, and I felt very virile. And 2 days later, I go to my dentist in New York. I had gone to my dentist, but I had a very deep cavity, and he had sent me to a chiropodist. And I go into a building, Midtown, New York, and they have those elevators. And I hear a voice say, kindly call out your floors, please. And I say, 16. And the doors close, and the elevator starts going up to 16. And on the way up, the elevator says to me, are you the guy that hit the television set? I felt like an ass, you know? And it took me up and down fast between floors. And it threw me off in the basement. And it yelled out something that was anti-Semitic. And the upshot of the story is that day, I call my parents. My father was fired. He was technologically unemployed. My father worked for the same firm for 12 years. They fired him. They replaced him with a tiny gadget this big. It does everything that my father does, only it does it much better. The depressing thing is my mother ran out and bought one.
That really is wonderful stuff. Woody Allen. And that'll wrap up this edition of Funny Stuff. Next week's program is a salute to the telephone, and as it's been used in comedy. I'm not sure yet, but I think I'll feature, of course, Bob Newhart, Shelley Berman, and Lily Tomlin, among others. And let's see. If you want to get a hold of me, don't call the station because I pre-record the program. I am found here at odd times, but the best thing to do is to write. If you want to just send your phone number in an envelope, and I'll call you back. The address is Bob Claster, C-L-A-S-T-E-R, K-C-R-W, that's K-C-R-W, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. And, you know, I'll get a hold of you. Let's see. That's about it. I told you about next week's show. I told you about this week's show. And, I got nothing else to say other than thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you'll join me next week when we feature the telephone. So until then, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening, which I already did, and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised because you never know when you're going to need it. Good night, everybody.